Illinois lawmakers went home last week after passing a budget, plus measures on fracking, the carrying of concealed weapons, and the next step in building a third Chicago-area airport. They did not pass bills on same-sex marriage and the opening of new casinos in Chicago, Danville, and other cities. And they did not pass anything on pension reform, an idea that's attracted general support, but little agreement. What's the story with the legislation that state lawmakers did and did not pass during their spring session? What's the impact it will have on people in Illinois, and what political pressures will be on lawmakers and Governor Pat Quinn in the months ahead? I'm Jim Meadows, and we'll be talking about the spring legislative session and its aftermath with Tom Kasich, political reporter for the News Gazette, and Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. That's coming up on Focus right after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Now, I admit that I could not find this on the internet yesterday, but I'm pretty sure that someone once said that you really don't want to know how lunch meat or laws are made. I have not inspected my lunch very closely, but our guests today on Focus have spent a lot of time in Springfield reporting on the spring session of the Illinois General Assembly. That session is over, and laws have been passed pending approval by Governor Pat Quinn. Other bills have been defeated or not voted on at all, including at least one that nearly everyone agrees is needed in some form. Today on Focus, we'll look at what our Illinois lawmakers did this spring and what remains to be done and what it means for all of us. With me in the studio today is Tom Kasich, political reporter for the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette. And joining me on the phone from Springfield, Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Tom and Amanda, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Jim.
And again, if you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can call in at 333-9455 or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Just to start off, I know usually the big issue in the spring session is the budget, always a race to get the budget done, maybe late sessions to get the budget done. But pension reform really seemed to get the lion's share of the had-to-do attention this time. And I'm wondering, let me start with you, Tom, why is that?
Well, it's probably the biggest problem the state has faced in 25 or 30 years, that we have a growing pension obligation that no one seems to have a handle on how to diminish it or how to cut it and how to pay it. So and it's cutting into all other budget items. It's cutting into education spending, higher education spending, public safety, just about everything else. So those issues get shunted aside because the pension issue is such a, it's an 800-pound gorilla.
Amanda, I was wondering, I've heard the phrase pension crisis used. Do you think we're at crisis level as far as state pensions are concerned?
You know, I do think that that is a word that is often used, and as Tom said, because it cuts into so many other areas of the budget, it becomes more of a problem. It's not just that the pensions are an issue, it is the domino effect that it has on other spending areas and pressures. That said, I think that you would have those who say that not that this is much ado about nothing, but that this is perhaps much more is being made of than need be in terms of pensions, given that there is a 1995 law that basically set how much was supposed to go toward all of the pensions, and that's what we're looking to, and that was kind of backlogged, and so Illinois is getting the hardest hits right now, and the thought being that as the ramp begins to level off and taper down, that the pressures will begin to ease and that it won't be the level of crisis. You have plenty of people who say, no, this is a crisis, regardless of that 95 ramp. If you, just like a credit card, if you put off paying more later, it continues to add to the debt, and you have to pay more in interest. Obviously, Illinois just saw another credit rating, already the lowest in the nation, but now another bond house has said, Fitch's just said following the legislature's adjournment, that it has a negative outlook for Illinois and lowered the grade even further for the state. And so that means that it will be more expensive for Illinois to borrow. And I think also just a political crisis. As more attention is put toward the issue, then it becomes a bigger deal and people look more toward their politicians to either do something or what is it that they are doing.
Well, I understand there are two bills out there. The Senate has one, the House one has one, with the Democratic leaders of both chambers championing those bills. And they can't agree. I understand one of them is more, has the backing of unions. One of them does not. The union, the backed bill, the backers of that saying they're the ones that can survive a court challenge. I take it they're both going to, either one would end up in court. Whatever gets passed would get a court challenge. What stops the two sides of the same party, I should add, from agreeing?
You know, as you said, I do think that no matter what happens, it will go to court. And even if, so we're talking about President of the Senate, John Cullerton, has one plan, House Speaker Mike Madigan has the other. It's Cullerton's plan that has the backing of unions, but which critics say doesn't do enough to save Illinois money. It basically gives employees and retirees a whole bunch of options that they can choose from, and that means that they would be it would be the employee opting into breaking the contract with the state and thereby getting around the constitutional clause that says pension benefits cannot be diminished nor impaired. And yet, even if the unions have backing, any retiree, any sole individual could take this to court, either as a class action lawsuit or what have you. That Madigan plan does not give that option, but saves a whole lot more money, and that's where critics of it say, hey, you're just there's no choice, and you are unilaterally cutting pension benefits, and that's why it would not be able to withstand a court challenge. I think what you have here are what these individuals, or at least President Cullerton, has tried very much to make out as a difference of legal theory, and because they are each held so steadfastly to those theories, that is why it is hard to come to a compromise on this. Despite Cullerton saying that, no, he's getting along fine with Speaker Madigan, I do think that, yes, you have a personality very much coming into play. These may be, as the Senate's Republican leader, Christine Rodonio, who favors the Madigan version, has said that, is this maybe a case of trying to determine who's going to be top dog here? Is this a case of President Cullerton? Because all of the other caucuses, the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans, agree with the House Democrats on the Madigan version. Could this be, Cullerton just not wanting to give in? He doesn't want to have a legacy as a pushover of giving in to Madigan, who's kind of got this reputation of like the Wizard of Oz in the Capitol. And so I do think that you have a degree of that, and then the caucuses go along with that. They buy into all of that. It's kind of like being on a team in high school. You very much root for your own, and there is that issue as well.
I'm wondering, Tom, when you look at the lawmakers in this area, do they agree with their leaders as to the wisdom of their chamber's particular bill, or do they have other thoughts, and will they voice them?
That's the interesting thing on the two pension bills, that Madigan's bill got a vote in both houses. Cullerton's only got a vote in his house, in the Senate. His passed overwhelmingly in the Senate, 40-16, and supporters in the House insisted that it would have gotten at least 80 votes in the House, and it needed to be called, but Madigan would never call it. It was stuck in the House Rules Committee and never got out. Madigan's bill passed the House, but only by 11 votes, and it got killed in the Senate. Killed is the wrong word here, but it was overwhelming. It lost 16-42, so... I think there's a lot of support for Cullerton's bill, not just among the unions, but especially among downstate legislators who have a lot of state employees in their districts. And there's a lot of state legislators downstate who have a lot of state jobs. So I think that would have passed. It certainly wouldn't have had the financial effect that Madigan's bill would have had, but maybe it needed a vote.
And that's why people are predicting that Madigan didn't call it, because then it would have passed, and where would he have been left? He would have lost, if that's really how this is termed, if it's a battle between the two leaders, if that's the case. There's, of course, plenty of speculation here as to, what all goes on there and behind closed doors and the strategy. But I do think that yes, as Tom had said, the conventional wisdom was that the Cullerton version would have gotten out of the House, and that's what Madigan doesn't want to happen because he doesn't believe in it.
Yeah.
Well, there was a meeting that the governor held this week with the two Democratic legislative leaders, Republicans not invited apparently, and Madigan did not even show up. And I assume it wasn't just because I heard the talk about him being out of state without a cell phone, as if he might not have heard about it or forgot or something. But I imagine that if he wanted to go, he would have.
You know, I found that whole thing really bizarre. I'll be honest. It is known that Madigan does not have a cell phone, nor does he work off of email. And in a way, that's strange. In a way, he's kind of like, I don't know, the Queen of England presumably doesn't either. They have staff that do that for them, you know? Yes, it is also, I think, well known that Madigan generally does take off after vacation. I believe there is an annual trip that he has. And one would have thought that on both ends, this would have been figured out prior to his having missed the meeting. Either Quinn, before, saying, hey, I'm going to call a meeting, and then, oops, where did Madigan? I can't believe he didn't show. Before announcing that I'm calling the leaders, confirm if they're going to be able to be there or not, because I think Quinn comes off looking and demonstrating the lack of connection that he has. Toward the end of session, it is kind of, he's been called an outsider, a mere observer in this whole process. Besides saying that, yes, he wants pensions to be taken care of, that he hasn't actually presented a plan. The session prior, he had a couple of bullet points, but past that, he hasn't actually come out with anything. And this, I think, goes to show that if he doesn't even know that the speaker's not going to come to the meeting that he had just called, and also, plan in advance. As soon as the pension plan doesn't pass, be ready with action, and instead of waiting for a bond downgrade to come out and say, hey, I'm going to call a meeting for the next day. That said, Madigan, I think, you would have thought they could have come up with a better PR strategy instead of saying, hey, he doesn't have a cell phone and we can't contact him. It's not like he is, in a war-torn zone. He's in the United States, I believe, perhaps in Florida. Go to the hotel, borrow somebody else's cell phone, and get on that call, or come out and say, we had previous plans. We do believe that pensions are a vital issue. However, we were just contacted the night prior, and we're not able to accommodate the schedule. We look forward to meeting with the governor and the Senate president in the future. I think they both come off just looking silly, and yet I think it demonstrates to the public what is at hand here. And when I say that it's more than just a legal theory, it is these personalities that come into play. And this, I think, is evidence of that.
Is there a political price to play for not doing anything? Or do they think that there's, or do the leaders think there is still some wiggle room to fight this out?
Well, I have a theory that is probably quarter-baked, not even half-baked, but it is that this whole thing is kind of a charade, and it's all going to be delayed till a point where it has a better, where it has the maximum political advantage, and that is you resolve this either before the primary, if that matters. You take care of it in February or March of 2014, or you do it late in the session next year, where it helps Dems, and they can claim that they resolve this terrible pension crisis, and it's 5 months before the election. Otherwise, I cannot explain why this thing cannot get fixed. I mean, there's a obvious disagreement on the some of the principles here, but you got to try something. You've got to pass something, or you'll just look so inept. It's like the Republicans have been saying on the floor. These guys have gigantic advantages in both houses, and they can't even get together on the most important issue in the state. So, Amanda, you said it was silly. It looks silly, and that's so true. And when you have these numbers, you're supposed to be able to accomplish things, and they can't do it.
And maybe, Amanda, do the leaders foresee the possibility of passing the wrong bill, besides whatever would be good for the state, but also the wrong bill that would backfire on them politically, because it is going to mean some change in the pensions for an awful lot of public employees, state and local public employees.
Right, and public employees, where this, I think, really does factor into the election and cannot be forgotten, is how important they are in elections, and particularly to Democrats, that you have teachers unions and that are very strong because, of course, teachers are in every single district, and in downstate districts or such as in Champaign, obviously a lot of university employees who are educated, who vote, who know about the pension issue and about the candidates. And so there's so much at play here that, you know, perhaps the end game is to make this look as absolutely difficult as possible and get it out there so that voters understand, and despite unions being upset at what is being done to their pensions and any sort of reductions to their benefits, that that is offset because the public cry for change is so great, or that it comes late enough that Democrats have somehow, you know, aligned themselves still, because in a way unions really don't have anywhere to go. They did give, and part of the, you know, scuttlebutt is that perhaps Madigan has been so held tightly to his plan that does further reduction cuts is because he's bothered with unions, because they have, you know, as Illinois has faced these budget struggles, continued to, in cases, at least in with back contracts, not so much the new one, the raises aren't, you know, all that high, but in the past that Illinois was, you know, required to do that, to pay those out, and also that unions had given, particularly, for example, some of the teachers ones given to Republican candidates, mm-hmm. and that he didn't like that. So there's, I think, so many scenarios that you can play out in terms of what the end strategy is. Everybody talks about, for example, governor. We've had so far a couple of Republicans, Treasurer Dan Rutherford, and just today, Bruce Rauner, saying that they were going to try for the GOP primary. And as you look forward to 2014, is Attorney General Lisa Madigan going to be part of this? What do Democrats want to do? Do they want to lift up Pat Quinn, or do they want to make him look bad by dragging this out?
Well, let's take a break in this particular part of the discussion to take a phone call. And on line one, we have Danny, who's been waiting patiently in Urbana. Good morning, Danny. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. I'm pleased that you're discussing this topic. And the point I would like to make, what dismays me about the public discussion of this issue by the politicians and the press, glosses over the moral dimensions of this problem. What we're talking about is deferred compensation. I will be upfront. I'm someone who's in the SUR system. So,
and that's the state university. That's
state
for
university
state
retirement system.
Right.
When I began my employment, promises were made to me that in exchange essentially for not a full salary, I will have pension benefits that are accrued. And at the point at which, under Blagojevich, they began, had the pension payment holiday, which another topic is, you know, Chicago is asking for one now as though that's a good idea. But I talked to our local representative about that, and I said, you know, the idea that you can skip payments for 2 years and catch up in years three, four, and five is ridiculous, because no state legislature is bound by the actions of the previous. I was assured that I'm protected by the Constitution and the money will be there and da-da-da-da. Well, here we are a decade later, and no one is talking about the fact they're phrasing it as if money we spend on pensions takes away money from education and health services and da-da-da-da, as if pension costs are not a part of education. How can you hire a teacher? The money in education primarily goes to salaries. How can you hire a teacher that's bright enough that you would want them teaching your children and tell them, you work for us for your career and we'll stiff you on the pensions? Hmm. So the pension expense is an education expense, and they took it out earlier. It needs to be paid back. The framing of this is if it's the union's bosses against responsible people,
right,
ignores the fact that the unions are the collective voice of state employees, and they have not been the vigorous voice that I would like to hear. So the unions have agreed to the Cullerton plan that imposes a 2% tax off the top of my salary.
So I take it you're not very happy about that plan either, I take it.
I'm not very happy about that plan. I'm extremely upset because if there's going to be a tax increase, it should be a tax increase that covers all of the people who benefited from the diversion of funds over the last 15 and 20 years. And what they're doing is they're imposing a tax increase on state employees and nobody else, as if the people from the state didn't in some sort of way benefit from the fact that the pension payments weren't made as the law required at the time they were due.
Well,
there's a real moral element to this,
yes.
And people need to be talking about it because it's ridiculous to think that the University of Illinois can hire people that are reasonably bright with this sort of discussion, this sort of action going on. Why would you take a job with an employer who's so callous about these sorts of promises? The News Gazette takes the attitude of simply a political problem. If a private sector employer, if Kraft or if Flex and Gate, anybody else other than a political employer behaved in this manner, the outcry by the politicians and by the press would be huge. I mean, the fact that it's the state that is behaving in this manner doesn't change the basic fact that what they're doing is unethical.
I do think that there is a private versus public question here. And when you look over, for example, to Wisconsin and Governor Scott Walker and the battle that has gone on with unions there, I do think that there are some members of the private sector who would not be so shocked and who would say, hey, my pensions have been cut. I haven't gotten a raise. Well, union workers, members of AFSCME, the state's largest public employees, continued to, despite the economic downturn. And so I think that that's part of what politicians are looking at. You have those who represent districts that have a lot of public workers who, of course, are sticking up for them in that regard. But those who don't so much say, hey, we've got to do this. There's a political element there. That said, of course, you have this was a promise that was made. I do not know. Perhaps another theory is that all of this is being done so that it could go to the courts, and then perhaps the courts will throw it out, and then it would lead to an actual tax increase that politicians would say, hey, we have no choice but to do this. We tried.
Yeah.
You hit on something when you talked about, why would an employee want to go work for an organization? And there's questions in both the Madigan plan and that newer workers were that they came onto the quote-unquote tier two that institutions such as the U of I are having a hard time recruiting employees or holding on to them, because of both the question of pensions and will what has been promised been paid, and also because the benefit reductions are so great that it doesn't look very good at all. And that comes also into the cost shift, because you have Speaker Mike Madigan, who wants to move expenses that the state now pays for the employer's share of a retirement benefit for both university and for teachers outside of Chicago, and move those costs from the state to the employers themselves, saying that, hey, you shouldn't even be, part of this state pension system. So I think that there's a whole lot at play here. One other thing to come back to the argument, and is the caller had described it, a diversion of funds, which really is he said, something that has to, I think, just by nature of, trying to evolve and report the latest news, but should be mentioned or acknowledged in this story here in terms of what caused this issue in the first place. It is not that there are pension benefits that are crazy and, estate workers and university workers are walking away with these grand and fabulous pension plans. There are a couple of people who, have piled pension on top of pension on top of pension. Those are mostly people with political connections. But for the most part, at least if you look at the figures that AFSCME provides, it's not as if these are golden pensions. It was caused because the state didn't pay into the pension funds what it was supposed to. And that's where this comes from. Again, as a reporter here, the balanced argument that everybody is saying on this, when the state did divert those funds, it was often with the blessing of unions who, wanted the money to go to all of those diverted areas. Sure.
Can I make one more
put more
point
into school, put more into
yes.
all these other areas.
Yes, Danny, your point.
The pension and salaries, given the level of education, working for a public university in Illinois, are modest compared to many private sector universities. And I was curious a year or so ago to see what sort of pension plan if I went to work at Kraft or Caterpillar, who are major corporate 500 employers. And the combination of what a private company like Kraft has to pay through the FICA taxes, Social Security, plus what they will top up by an employer match through 401k plans where for every dollar the employee puts in, they will match it. An employee can have 14.5% to 15% pension costs on top of his salary from a place like Kraft. And the state of Illinois has not been paying that kind of money on our pensions. And, you know, for Kraft, if they defer the FICA payment for a quarter, the feds are there with handcuffs and they do a perp walk because the money has to be put into the system. And in Illinois, the politicians have not been putting the money in. And, you know, the voters keep voting the same crew back in. But, you know, there really is, in my mind, a moral element here, as well as obviously legal elements, but you can't, it seems impossible to indict our legislators.
I agree.
So that's all I have to say. Yeah.
Danny, thank you very much for calling. And I'm just wondering if we can wrap up this part. We're halfway through the show, and we haven't figured out pension reform either. But do either of you see any movement, let's say, this summer on negotiation towards some sort of pension reform that will pass both chambers?
You're going to need more more groups like Fitch to trigger it.
Fitch, right? Ratings, which downgraded the bond rating for
the
state.
You're going to need more of the bond houses to come out and say, this is ridiculous. You got to act, and otherwise, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't see any great outcry from the public. Maybe around here, but you know, people are on vacation. They have other issues. So.
Amanda, do you see anything happening in the near future?
I can't see any sort of consensus being reached in the near future. I do see, just because this is a mess for Governor Quinn, him perhaps trying to call. There's a lot of talk, special session, yes, no, what will happen? I think that that is a possibility, given that, as was mentioned, there is the potential of a pension holiday for Chicago Public Schools, because they need a whole lot more money in coming years, and there is talk of needing that resolved by August, so perhaps bringing legislators back to Springfield by then. If I were Governor Pat Quinn, I sure as heck would try and get something done, because to bring legislators back to take care of Chicago and not state pensions would look even worse. But I don't know what would possibly change as you look between Cullerton and Madigan at this point in time in getting something through the General Assembly, much as Quinn may want that.
Okay, well, we're going to, after we take a short break, we're going to look at the rest of what state lawmakers did or did not do during this spring session. We're talking about the Illinois General Assembly spring session with Tom Kasich of the News Gazette and Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio. This is Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we are talking about what happened in the spring session of the Illinois General Assembly with Tom Kasich of the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette and Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Laws are like sausages. It is better not to see them being made. That's the quote I was searching for at the beginning of the show. Otto von Bismarck is the source of that quote, and I want to thank Pius Weibel, former Champaign County Board Chairman, who, of course, as a former county board member, has his own experience in seeing the laws made. But we're talking today about laws on the state level and what happened in the spring session. Our phone numbers are 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, and you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. As I said at the beginning of the show, usually all the big fighting is about the budget. There was a budget, and it seemed to go over and get passed and sent to the governor's desk with relatively little fuss, or did I miss something?
Didn't that go in, Amanda, didn't that go in like 4 days?
Yeah, exactly. It was wild. You're right.
It came out Monday, and it was
easy. It was to have missed, and I think part of that was because it was split up into all these separate bills, so it wasn't as if there was one budget to follow. And also because you had Democrats in agreement on it, sure, Republicans made a fuss, but they pretty much always do,
yeah.
And they're in the minority, and that doesn't much matter. Their votes weren't needed.
We're here at the University of Illinois, WILL, and President Robert Easter has sent a memo out to everybody at the university looking at the budget, and they're happy because higher education did not see any serious cuts this time around in its state funding. He's unhappy because there's no pension reform deal. But what else is in that budget? Is there anything that the Illinoisans ought to be aware of? I mean, crickets.
It's a lot like this year, isn't it? Last year.
Mm-hmm. It takes off of what has already been passed and also includes some of what it's based, therefore, sort of on what the governor had said. I think we're still kind of looking through it and figuring out. I'm sure there are nuggets in there that will make for interesting news or tidbits in terms of particular programs or grants. But generally what you saw was legislators relying on what has become known and sounds like a whole lot of fun, and I guess for Democrats it was the April surprise, and basically just additional tax revenue coming in, and also because of some issues regarding the federal government, that Illinois got more money. And lo and behold, the month before, they had to pass a budget that basically made it a whole lot easier. I think you would have seen an entirely different budget and a whole lot more quibbling and fighting over things such as the governor's budget's proposal to do further cuts to education spending that didn't have to happen because they relied on this revenue. And that is the criticism that you get from Republicans, is that, again, it did pass so swiftly, not just in one day, so they actually, granted, had a couple of days to look it over, but without a whole lot of time for the public to vet it, and that Illinois is just kind of continuing to live in a dream world because relying on this extra revenue, it should have been used to pay the past debts and basically the backlog of bills. So when you look at it, yeah, there are cuts to some places, but they were generally fairly even, 1% or 2% or so, and most places did get level funding after, of course, years of cuts.
Now, that raises the question, are we going to see in the fiscal year ahead the same cash flow problems with delays in state money actually arriving at its destination to places like school districts and state universities and also contractors and agencies receiving grants?
I believe so. I think, you're still going to have this gigantic backlog of bills. We're still, maybe $5 billion in the hole in the red right now. And, revenue is coming in. The tax increase has helped boost revenue to the state, and the state economy is doing fairly well. But there's still this enormous backlog of bills to pay, and that's going to affect payments to schools and counties and nursing homes and everybody else.
Looking over to some of the other bills that did pass, I was wondering what you thought about the concealed carry bill. This is the bill setting out the specific rules for the legal carrying of concealed weapons in Illinois, and the state is under a federal judge's order to do this. I understand that they've got an extension of the deadline to early July now, but there is a bill. It got passed. How was this bill hashed out by all the parties, especially considering really the disagreement between Chicago and downstate on guns in general?
Well, this agreement was basically reached, again, right toward the end. Legislators are very good at procrastination, and I think it's sometimes because in this case, you had a lot of Chicago legislators kicking and screaming. They don't want people to be able to carry guns in public, period. But again, because of this federal court order, really had no choice. So it was a battle between, protections of the Second Amendment on behalf of the gun rights advocates, and then on the part of gun control, protections for people, making sure that there were restrictions so that people don't get hurt or needlessly shot. And so what you had from the NRA and other organizations was that they wanted a statewide standard so that somebody that's, you know, toting a gun wouldn't cross into a different town or county and all of a sudden be breaking the law for having a gun when just a couple of steps back they were just fine. And so the law as it stands would give basically safe harbor. If you're in your car, it's okay. Private businesses would be able to say no. They'd have to put a sign outside, and then you would be able to go in, either in with your gun if they allow it or without. If not, you wouldn't be able to bring it in. The compromise increased basically. What you had was various proposals going out in through all session. And I think what really began to seal the deal was when the House passed a measure that was seen as overly on the side of gun control or a part of gun rights.
Right.
And so even though you had some quibbles with that because the gun rights folks say, hey, this wasn't everything we wanted, it nonetheless pushed the needle and allowed people to negotiate because they didn't want that to happen. What it would have done didn't even involve concealed carry. It would have basically taken away municipalities' ability to set any other sort of restriction on guns, such as Cook County's ban on assault weapons. And so that was what I think got these Chicago area legislators who didn't want anything to come to the table, again, even if it was kicking and screaming, because they didn't want that to happen. So it's all kind of a psychology that plays into it.
So that's something to keep in mind, assuming that this bill is signed as it is by the governor, that while a concealed carry, while citizens would be able to carry concealed weapons with proper authorization throughout the 102 counties, some bans on specific weapons, like assault weapons in Cook County, could still stand.
Right. If they had a home rule law, yes, that would still be in. This is the one bill the whole year, I think, that lawmakers can point to and say that, you know, there really was compromise, there really was a lot of discussion, there were a lot of votes. They really did devote a lot of time to this and came up with something that Republicans and Democrats could agree with and downstaters in Chicago. And, you know, I asked Kwame Raoul, who had been a sponsor of one of the bills, if he was happy with this, and he said, "No, I'm not happy, but this is the best we're going to get, and you know this satisfies everybody." So, but you know, like Amanda pointed out, they had to do something. This is the feds were breathing down their necks.
The governor could still veto this, or could try a mandatory veto.
That would be a huge mistake, I think.
It wouldn't get fixed by the July, I think it's 9th deadline. You think?
Right. If he vetoes this, he is ticking off everybody that voted for it, and every interest group. Well, maybe there's a few interest groups that wouldn't be angry, but he's got to watch it on this one.
Let me go to another bill that did pass, and that's a bill regulating fracking, hydraulic fracturing for extracting oil and natural gas. Is this likely to be signed? Is this going to go through as well?
Governor's energy guy, lobbyist, liaison, endorsed it in committee when I was there, and so I can't imagine the governor not signing it. And it's been sold as a big economic development tool for Southern Illinois. So, you know, I don't think there's any problem with this bill.
I don't think there is. I will take this opportunity, however, to point out that this is something that the governor said he wanted. It is kind of one of his big wins that he actually got, because in his major speeches, the budget address and his State of the State, he said he wanted a fracking bill with the strongest regulations in the country. That's supposedly, I haven't actually compared, so we're taking advocates on both sides' word for it in that regard. So he's getting his way on that. I do think that it was interesting to watch play out at this State House, however, because whereas environmental groups that did sign on to it, so such as the State Sierra Club, the NRDC, the Illinois Environmental Council, they still favor a moratorium. They don't want fracking, but just as it is actually reports of that already occurring in Illinois, it is better to be regulated and for them to have negotiated and come to the table than to have no restrictions at all. You still have plenty of environmentalists that are very upset about it, and they camped outside the governor's office. And I have to say, I think this was a bad move for Quint. He never met with them. He never, you know, even really acknowledged that. And it is Interesting. This is a governor who very much wants jobs, 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 because he's looking to run for re-election. And of course, it's all about the economy. This is also a governor who has long touted himself as the rivers guy and makes a big deal about the Illinois River Council. And this is the environmental questions about what fracking will do to the state's water resources still very much loom.
As far as what people should expect from this bill, I understand that after it's signed, there's still a rulemaking process that has to go on at the Department of Natural Resources. I don't know how long it will be before everything's in place for fracking under this law to actually get started.
You know, this will have to go through JCAR, and Amanda, you're certainly closer to this than I am, but doesn't this generally take like a year to get all the rules together and the regulations that would oversee something like this?
Yeah, it takes a long time there. I also think the Department of Natural Resources maybe now has money thanks to a law passed last year that increased what you pay on your license plate sticker renewal. But there is going to be so much question about, sure, there's a law, but it's the rulemaking, it's how permits are given, it's distrust of agencies to give the to go through and thoroughly vet everybody who they give a permit to, and then even if they issue a permit, how much follow up will there be? So this story is by no means done yet. You could see, I think, JCAR try and hurry it up, because if you, again, despite that some environmentalists don't want this at all, there's such widespread desire for this and for the jobs and money that it will supposedly bring to Illinois that maybe they'll hurry up the process some. But whenever Illinois hurries, there are questions about, oh, gosh, what did they miss and what did they mess up? You want to sometimes take the time to dot the I's and cross the T's. Yeah.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions about what Illinois lawmakers did or did not do this spring. With Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio, Tom Kasich of the News Gazette, our phone number 333-9455, toll free at 1-800-222-9455, our email address will-talk@illinois.edu. A couple of bills come to mind that did not get passed, that did not really come up to a vote, starting with gambling expansion. It's like third time at the altar for this one, but it never got a vote this time. If I'm keeping score correctly, do you expect this bill to be back? This is the bill that would, among other things, create new casinos, including in Chicago and Danville.
Yeah, this will be back, but it's the last view. The everything had been taken out of the bill, and they were starting all over. And that was like 3 days before they were supposed to adjourn. So it sort of fell apart at the end, and it's going to have to be rebuilt. The governor has said repeatedly, and I don't know if this is, if this is just talk or if he's serious, that he's not going to sign a gambling bill until there's pension reform. So there's that working against it. There's all sorts of disputes on who's going to get money. In the past there was money in there for soil and water conservation. There was money in there for the horsemen. It was kind of a Christmas tree bill itself, and there's certainly a lot of support for it, but there's also a lot of questions ethically and financially. So it's going to be a while, I think, before that passes.
At the same time, Amanda, maybe you know something about this. There are a lot of other lesser gambling expansion bills which did pass and are going to the governor's desk. I had a news release from ILCAP, the anti-gambling group, which listed some of them. Several of them would expand video gambling in various ways. One would allow electronic raffle machines and bars to be locally regulated, not regulated by the state. One would legalize poker runs as charitable gambling. Oh, yeah. And another one would extend a pilot program on internet racetrack betting. And what's going to happen to all these bills? Is the governor going to refuse to sign these until he gets pension reform as well? And even if he waits till then, it looks like they're on the way to becoming some sort of law. It looks like gambling is expanding or set to expand in Illinois.
Well, that's what Quinn observers, I would say, point out the irony in this situation, whereas he has said that he doesn't want such a massive expansion of gambling. There are those who say he already is the governor who allowed that to happen by being the governor who, in order to pay for capital construction programs across the state, authorized video poker in bars and restaurants and such. So I don't imagine that these would get enough attention or that Quinn would say that he's breaking his promise to put pensions first by signing any of these. The advanced deposit wagering, probably the most significant of those, and that's, I think, a story within itself in terms of what all went on there. But basically, Illinois had that, and money was supposed to go toward, for example, the struggling horse racing industry. And instead, the legislature allowed the law to sunset on that. And so basically, Illinois hasn't had advanced deposit wagering, this, you know, kind of being able to bet on the internet over horse races since, for all year. And so this gets that up and going. What you have is a state that's looking for money. And again, despite the budget kind of getting a pass because of the April surprise this year, Illinois very much is hard up for cash. And so I think Quinn would have a difficult time not signing those given that reality.
He's, you know, you talk about being hard up for cash, and one of these, I think it's a year and a half, the income tax phases out, you know, not all of it, but the income tax increase, and they're going to have to find money to replace that, and it, you know, gambling is certainly a great possibility, as is maybe possibly the extension of the income tax, or maybe move to a progressive tax. So that's really something to watch.
And the progressive tax idea, I think, is being sponsored by Naomi Jacobson, the Urbana Democrat here in this area.
Right, and it, you know, it went nowhere this year, but that's because there's not a, it's not an immediate problem yet.
A bill that passed the Senate is a same-sex marriage bill. It did not pass in the House. First Speaker Madigan and then the bill's own sponsor said that they just didn't have the votes and they didn't want to damage it by bringing it up. That bill could come back, I assume, but also I'm wondering what could be the impact on such a bill by whatever the U.S. Supreme Court says on the gay rights cases that it's looking at, that it could be ruling on in a few weeks.
That,
sorry, Tom.
I would just say I'm not familiar enough with the federal court ruling, but I think this legislation will come back. If not this year, then early next year. I think this is going to pass sometime in this session.
Yeah, there's an air of inevitability about it. It has been remarkable to watch in coming days since the bill was not called, and just kind of a lot of backtracking on what did and did not happen, in that the gay rights community very upset that they don't know who was on their side and who wasn't, and questioning the wisdom of the sponsor, Representative Greg Harris, for not having called it. Also a lot of questions in terms of the lobbying effort. There is some suggestion that Representative Harris resign a sponsor for not having called the bill, and if this doesn't get done, step down from his seat, period. He has refused to do so, and says that he wants to see this to fruition and believe in his choice, because once you have a vote out there, it would be hard for people to flip-flop or change on it. And if he had called it and it didn't actually go, the people who were on the fence put in a worse position for kind of sticking their noses out for no end result. So that has been fascinating just in coming days, and in a way perhaps put the pressure on further.
Let's, in the last couple of minutes, let me ask you about the next time legislators will be in town, and barring some special session being called this summer on pensions, I assume that'll be the fall veto session. And what could get done during that fall veto session besides simply looking at the governor's vetoes?
Before we move on, I do want to quick note another major piece of legislation that passed, although it wasn't in the last week's session, but worth pointing out just because it's significant in terms of social policy. Illinois did authorize marijuana for medicinal use, so we'll continue to see the fallout of that. Moving ahead, what happens in veto session in part depends on what Governor Pat Quinn does with what is on his lap and what is headed to his desk.
Including the medical marijuana bill, which I understand he's been sort of cagey about what he's going to do.
Exactly. So that could be one of them. An outstanding budget issue remains, and that is back wages for, to kind of go full circle into the beginning of the program, back wages for members of AFSCME, that Quinn rescinded raises for a couple years back now because there wasn't money appropriated in the legislature. The new contract deal that he'd reached, as well as there's a court case that right now has ordered the state to pay those back promised wages that have not been given, again, to state employees. And there wasn't money in the budget for that. So that's at least one thing that I think we'll see, and unions will surely not let legislators forget.
There's one little issue that I think a lot of people are watching, and that's the 70-mile-an-hour speed limit bill that passed both houses mm-hmm. and is enormously positive and popular. But the Quinn administration has indicated its opposition. But can you imagine him vetoing that bill 6 months before a primary?
Exactly. People want to get where they're going quicker, despite what Quinn says is a safety issue.
Yeah.
Well, we did not cover everything that the legislature did or did not do during this spring session in Springfield. Apologize for the measures that we missed, which have either been passed or are awaiting a final decision. But I do want to thank our guests, Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio and Tom Kasich of the News Gazette, for coming on the program today to try to hash out as much as we could.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's program was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director. Tomorrow on Focus, I'll talk with Larry Tye. His book on Superman is now out in paperback. Larry chronicles the history behind the Man of Steel created 80 years ago by a couple of high school kids in Cleveland. We'll look at what makes Superman an enduring part of pop culture. And we'll check in with Metropolis, the real Metropolis, the small town in southern Illinois, home of the Superman Museum and the annual Superman Celebration, which opens tomorrow. That's on Thursday's show. Focus is live every weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.